Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, proud of its ties to Alaska communities since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
Welcome to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Amy Bouchatz. Photographer Jeff Schultz has built a career in Alaska capturing stirring images of the state's wildlife, outdoor spaces, and the people, drama, and dogs of the last great race, the Iditarod. How does a California transplant, who started his time in Alaska slinging steaks at a now-shuttered Sizzler restaurant, shift into one of the state's most recognized landscape and wildlife photographers? In this episode of Outdoor Explorer, Jeff talks about his career, what he's learned photographing all things Iditarod, including portraits of the dogs, how he explores Alaska from behind the lens, and how you can too. That's just ahead on Outdoor Explorer.
I'm Shelby Herbert, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media and KUAC, where I work in Fairbanks, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Haines, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Acclaimed Alaska photographer Jeff Schultz has spent a career capturing stirring images of the state's wildlife, outdoor spaces, and the last great race, the Iditarod. In this episode of Outdoor Explorer, Jeff joins me, your host Amy Bouchatz, to talk about his career, what he's learned making photos of all things Iditarod, and how he explores Alaska from behind the lens. Jeff, thanks so much for joining me on Outdoor Explorer.
My pleasure.
So today we're going to talk about photography and adventure in Alaska, exploring outdoors. And I'm just really grateful that you have taken the time out of your busy life to do this with us. And also for sharing your expertise, because you really are an expert in this field. So thank you so much.
You bet. Happy to help.
Well, you're not originally from Alaska. So why don't you give us a little background? How'd you end up here? What's your getting to Alaska story?
Getting to Alaska stories, like many people, I think, where I grew up in the Bay Area of California, and lots of people and lots of pavement. And I loved the outdoors for whatever reason, mostly because my brother Larry took me backpacking and camping, my older brother. And so then I was, every chance I got, I went backpacking in Yosemite or the local regional park, whatever it was, hiking and such. And then I read a book about a gentleman who lived off the land in Alaska. And I wasn't really into people, still really aren't. And so I just, after reading that book, I thought, that's what I want to do. It wasn't the book everyone thinks, you know, up in Lake Clark. And I don't even know what the book was. But after reading that, I thought, that's exactly what I want to do. And after seeing a couple good movies like Jeremiah Johnson and things like that, that was it for me. And also reading Alaska Magazine, which my brother-in-law had at the time. So 3 months after graduating high school, I was in my pickup truck with my older brother. He was just coming up to hike and backpack with me. And here I was, ready for a job with Sizzler Family Steakhouse in Anchorage.
Good old Sizzler. a familiar brand to those of us from the Bay Area, too, which is where I'm from as well. I grew up going to Sizzlers. So, yeah. It's so interesting that, again, I'm from Santa Cruz, California, so also in the Bay Area region, sort of southern Bay Area. And it's so interesting that some of us from that region, not so into people either, end up here in a place that's, I mean, it's outdoorsy, but other than that, it's not really the same by any stretch of the imagination. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I concur. And, you know, in California, just the people weren't all that friendly necessarily, and I didn't care for a lot of them anyway. So up here, it's just totally different. The people are wonderful. Everybody will stop for you on the side of the road. You say hi to everybody. So it's just totally much more free and better up here.
Yeah, but from a weather standpoint, we're I don't know if we've
Well, yeah.
upgraded or downgraded, but it's certainly not the same.
Right. I mean, when I was younger, especially, I mean, I love it having four seasons here. I mean, yes, the winter's long, but man, growing up in California, we went and saw snow every couple of years or something when I was a little kid. So, and the snow's much better here anyway, light, fluffy. You just can't beat Alaska with a stick. So this is the
Yeah.
place to be.
Yeah, same. Although every now and then when I feel maybe not up to snuff in our harsh conditions, I think I am from a beach. That's why. It's just gonna take me more time.
Right.
I'm just of the ocean, you know. So,
Right.
yeah. How did photography become a central part of your life?
That's a good question. It wasn't at first, but in the seventh grade, my best friend Bob Finke, he brought his brother's 35 millimeter single lens reflex camera to school. His brother was in the Navy, bought this camera in Japan. It was an Asahi Pentax camera. And I looked through the camera and focused the lens, and it's almost like something clicked, you might say. Funny thing, huh? Anyway, there was just something about that. Looking through the camera, I pretty much immediately recognized that I had a God-given talent of composing photos. And in my opinion, photography is like most of art, is 90% composition. It's where you put stuff in the frame that matters. And I just love doing that. There was something about that that just made it work for me. And then I got encouragement from my brother-in-law and from other people when I took photos. I knew what a good photo was at a young age, and that did the trick.
What did you take pictures of in California? What was your favorite subject?
Well, again, well, landscapes, there was really no wildlife to speak of that I could find because I was too young and didn't have the patience or time. But landscapes, but I mean, I took pictures of everything. So in our backyard, our dog had left a few poop piles. So I took a little American flag and stuck it in that poop pile and took a picture of that. Not has nothing to do politically. It was just, I had an American flag, let's do that. So I
Yeah.
took pictures of everything. I mean, back then I photographed for the I had a job with the with a local photo studio, and I took pictures of high school sporting events and all kinds of stuff. So I love everything.
Yeah. Today, of course, and we're going to talk about this, you specialize in wildlife and landscapes. I imagine sporting events and the action involved there isn't that different from a composition and got to be on your toes standpoint, as from photographing bears in action, high school
Right,
football,
absolutely.
bears, same.
Yeah. Composition with a moving subject can be difficult, but
Yeah.
that's where I learned a lot of that, getting people running into the frame rather than running out of the frame.
Right. So I just mentioned that you specialize in wildlife and landscape up here. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what you specialize here in Alaska?
Well, honest, as a professional photographer, I had to specialize in everything. I had to do a little bit of advertising photography, a little editorial magazine photography. But my love has always been outdoor nature photography and adventure photography. But it's very difficult to make a living doing that, real difficult. Everybody and their brother, especially now, has a camera. But even back then, photographing landscapes, it wasn't a lucrative field to be in unless you had something really unusual. Even wildlife photography, like the masters of Alaska wildlife photography, like Johnny Johnson and Tom Walker and such, those guys, they were doing this with film and they did really great work for what they had to work with. And I come along, this wannabe photographer, And I just couldn't do that. I couldn't keep up with those guys. So I did what I could and started shooting stock photography where I'm putting people in the photo and things like that. I did whatever it took to make a living in photography. And, by the grace of God, I was self-employed at the age of 21 and have been ever since. So I was shooting weddings and portraits too because I wanted to make a living, anyway. So
Yeah.
that's the, specializing in Alaska, you have to be a jack of all trades as a
Sure.
profession, typically.
Sure. You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Amy Bouchotz, and I'm talking to photographer Jeff Schultz. So how do you go from a sizzler steak specialist to getting into the field and making it that professional thing? Because as you just mentioned a little bit ago, so many people are eager to be professional photographers, especially in Alaska, where wildlife is just everywhere. It seems like subjects are just falling out of the sky, sometimes literally. How do you create that bridge?
Well, I having an entrepreneur spirit is a big deal. So I'm left brain and right brain, creative, and I have some smarts on the other side. So that's really what helps because when I was a cook at Sizzler on the side, I was photographing weddings and portraits, for a couple hundred bucks. It was really embarrassing being in the back of Sizzler throwing steaks. And in line is one of my clients that I'm photographing their wedding this weekend. That was pretty crazy. But in addition to that, then on the side of all that, I did my landscape photography and just hoped and prayed that I could get it published. And I took one of my photos to a local printer, AT Publishing back then, and they're still around. Anyway, and I said, "Hey, I've got this photo," and they said, "Well, that's nice. We'll put it on a calendar." So it's that entrepreneurial spirit where it's go and do everything I could to promote myself. That took a lot, and I don't particularly care for it, but that's what it took to break into the business.
Yeah. You really made a carved out a spot for yourself as stock photography. Now, as a journalist and an editor of newspapers, I'm very familiar with the need for stock photography. Sometimes you don't have the news photo that you need. Sometimes you just need something that works. And been in content production like that for a long time. But maybe other people listening to this don't know what stock photography is. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the short version is a stock photo is a picture that a photographer thinks up of a bright idea and goes out and photographs it and then hopes to sell it down the road. In other words, it's not an assignment photo. Nobody's paid him to go out there and do that. So my most famous photo is a picture of an igloo lit up at night. And that's got a great backstory because, I'd get a call every year or two. A couple times a year for a picture of an igloo, and I'd say, "Go away, you're bothering me." An igloo is not something that people live in regularly. It's a temporary shelter, and
Sure.
not a lot of pictures of them. And anyway, I went out and made one of these pictures, and I said, "Duh, why don't we do that?" And that photo, hit like a ton of bricks. It made over $100,000 over a
Wow.
15 or 20 year period.
That's
So
crazy.
if a photographer can think up a good idea and then execute on it, they can probably make a decent living. They could anyway. Nowadays, it's a race to the bottom price-wise. So I don't recommend professional photography, quite frankly, unless you're doing something with assignments in mind, like weddings or magazine work.
So a good thing, a good place to take your passion. What is your favorite subject to photograph in Alaska right now, these days?
It's still landscape photography, though my absolute all-time favorite would be a small animal or the small person in the big landscape. Something to show scale and something to show what's going on. So a small hiker that's, hiking on a glacier or a bear walking along the shore with some mountains in the background. Everybody, their brother wants to get a picture of a close-up of a bear jumping for salmon or something, which is great. I love that too. But I'd rather have the bear jumping for salmon with a killer background in there, whatever that may be.
How does photography help you explore outdoors in Alaska? How has it helped you get around? Because you have gotten around, so tell us about that.
Well, they go hand in hand. So part of that is seeing somebody else's photo of an area and then going to that location, which I try my best not to photograph with other photographers. I don't
Okay.
want the same picture everybody else has. I try not to go to the places that everybody else is going to. Or if I do go there, like such as Brooks
I
Falls,
was going to say,
everybody's
so
my
no
brother.
bear camp photo
Yeah,
trip for you.
right. Everybody has or wants that picture of the salmon jumping into the mouth. But it's been done before, so why go that route? And anyway, getting out in the outdoors, it's like I just love being out there. So they go hand in hand, and I want to get to see new and different places. So
There's
that
a
helps.
lot of that in Alaska.
Lots.
Coming out your ears almost. New and different places for every day of the week till you die.
Yeah.
At least as far as I've found. What's your favorite location? I mean, don't reveal too many secrets now, but what's your
I
favorite
don't.
location to photograph in Alaska?
Favorite locations, that's hard. Anything with mountains, glacier, flowers, and wildlife, that's me. I'm constantly looking for that. So if you know any places that I haven't been, so oftentimes I'm just hunting. Like the other day, I was hunting, not hunting, but I was online looking just up in Hatcher Pass area, and I stumbled into this photo of this lake, and I thought, and it was just a picture that Joe Blow took. They happened to be up there, and I thought that on the right day at the right light with everything working for me, that would make a stunning photo. So now I'm trying to hunt out, well, how do I get there? Is it going to take a 10-mile hike or a 20-minute helicopter ride, or what's it going to take? So I guess that's how I go about doing that.
Yeah. Do you ever find yourself, so what you just described is like hunting for location and then going there. Do you ever find yourself stumbling on location and then making a photo based off of that?
Oh yeah, absolutely, all the time. I'm oftentimes stumbling into something. This last summer I was out along Kinnick River, and I just saw a little opening in the woods, and I thought, well, what's down that trail? You go down that trail for 100 yards, and then boom, it opens up, and you got this field of fireweed and just a different angle. And different angles is what I'm all about. I want to do something different, and I'm very fortunate to have friends that are pilots. So, they love to fly. Every pilot loves to turn fossil fuel into noise and airspeed. And
Yes.
so I just going out with them, and then that's the cat's meow, because now I'm able to photograph aerial pictures, but I'm also able to find locations that could work. And then I'm able to look and find a trail or somehow that I can get there from here.
I could use more friends that are pilots. If you know of any
Yeah.
taking applications,
Yeah.
I think that's a co common refrain from Alaskans is more friends who are pilots who want to fly you around because that gets if they're not your buddy, that gets pricey real fast.
Boy, howdy.
Is there any part of Alaska that you don't like to photograph? Anything you've found that you've said, you know what, seen enough of this, not coming back?
No, every place in Alaska is fabulous. I prefer the mountains. But even, when I've been out on the North Slope and stuff like that, or Fairbanks where there's no mountains, there's always something to photograph. There's always dog poop, right? So,
Keep a pocket flag. I'm not going to comment on the nation to which that should be affiliated, but you do
No.
you. You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Amy Bouchatz. I'm talking to Jeff Schultz, who's an Alaska photographer and has made a career of shooting landscapes and wildlife in the state, and produced some of the best-known Alaska photography. Probably have seen images of his floating around out there. So Jeff, I'm wondering about following your curiosity outside. You just mentioned, seeing an image from Hatcher Pass and wanting to then go explore that, or being on the Kinnick River. and wondering, hey, where does that path go? Following that and finding a scene that you just had to capture. Do you have any insights on how to have that kind of attention in our attention deficit society where it's really easy to miss that stuff?
It is. I mean, the answer to your question is no, I don't really have it, but I'll fake it. The I think the key for me is just getting out in the outdoors and looking around. Just have to find stuff, or looking at a map and just find a dirt road and go down it. A lot of time I do a lot of scouting to try to find those unusual locations. And so I'll be driving around and I'd literally see a dirt road or a paved one. I'll say, well, what's down that? And then just drive down it and turn around because there might be something behind me. And that's a great way to just get out and see something new and different.
It's only, I think what you're describing is like a practice of awareness and just building that as a habit where you're willing to ask that question instead of being destination driven or goal focused. These are things that I like to do. I'm going to that peak. I'm doing this mileage today. I'm exploring this spot, is what I tend to do instead of just going and then letting it take me wherever I end up.
Right. Yep. That's what I love to do is let it take me wherever I end up and I find something unique.
Do you ever, on the flip side, find that because you're looking through a viewfinder, that you miss other things going on, that you become too narrow focused?
Yes, is the answer to the question. There are times where I'm looking through the viewfinder, especially doing aerial photography or something, where you got, 360 degree view of everything going on and it's wonderful. And I'm looking through a little tiny portion of it. But I get out there often enough, that I don't, that's not a big deal to me, that I enjoy enough of it that, I've been doing it for over 45 years. So for me, it's not an issue, but I understand, especially if you're doing video, still photography is much easier in that you're always looking around, looking which way to point the camera and what to zoom in on, as opposed to video, you're constantly looking through the viewfinder. So I do shoot some video and I know in video, at least, that is a problem that I'm con because I have to always be composing just right. So I'm focused. No pun, but I'm looking right there, focused on the subject at hand, and that's then for sure I miss things.
So how do you take your, if you're an amateur photographer, how do you take your career from like, hey, I'm just shooting pictures, I'm, trying to make a living doing this, taking wedding photos, shooting very specific things for stock photography, to I get to follow my curiosity?
Well, what I did, I guess, is I went out and experimented doing other types of work and then got it out there into the world and let people see it. That's the big ticket. You got to show it out there on social media these days or whatever. We didn't have social media back in my day when we were, when I was pivoting and doing different things. But it's following the passion. There's photography out there, or any art, where you just have to see if it works. And the only way a person's going to know if it works is to get it out there and let people see it and critique it. And don't get a big head about it if somebody says, or get hurt feelers because someone says, hey, this sucks. Well, there's a lot of my photography that people don't like. But I tell people when I teach photography, I tell people, if you like your picture, it's good. Don't let me or anybody else tell you it's not, because I'm out there. I'm in my photography, I try to please myself first. And there's some pictures I've taken. I'm staring at one right now that I wouldn't, it's not that great of a picture in my opinion, but I love it. If that, I mean, that's a dichotomy, but, and I say it's not a great picture because it hasn't, not a lot of people appreciate it, but
Can
I
you
love it.
describe it for us?
It's got some rocks in the lower left. It's got some mountains in the back. It's really cloudy day. There's not an inch of blue sky, and it's blowing like a mad dog. So it's on a beach kind of thing. And so there's a bunch of sand blowing, and it's just, kind of okay. But just the other day, I sold it for a few thousand dollars as a stock photo for a brand new company. Now, beyond before that though, it just sat around and nobody really commented on it. So you can't know.
Yeah, other than the fact that you just sold it for several thousand dollars, what do you love about it? Why do you love it?
I don't know that I can tell you. It's peaceful to me. It shows a place I've been, and it's the composition. It's just
It
my
speaks
eye
to you.
moving around. Yeah, the big deal, composition is such that my goal to compose a photo is for someone to look at the photo and keep circling around the photo, back and forth, looking at all the intricacies so that their eye doesn't go out of the frame. And if I succeed at that, which I did in this picture, even though people don't think it's, there's no blue sky, there's no sun, there's, it's just kind of blasé. But boy, it sure captures my attention anyway.
But it's not that unlike I like what you're describing to me is not that unlike being in that moment, right? So where you are, where I can imagine myself standing in this spot that you just described. And if I'm fully present there, I'm doing the same thing that you're describing a person might do when they look at the photo, which is circulating through that and noticing all of the things and feeling it in your senses and all of that stuff that I don't have the smell and I don't have the wind on my face and the grit of the sand while I'm looking at your photograph, but I can imagine those things if the photo is speaking to me.
Correct. And maybe it's just not speaking to everybody.
Fair enough.
Speaks to me, but anyway.
Yeah.
So hopefully that helps.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Amy Bouchatz, and I'm talking to Jeff Schultz about photography in Alaska and seeing the outdoors through a camera lens. We'll be back with Jeff after this break.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime, wherever you get your podcasts, or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Amy Bouchatz, and I'm talking to professional wildlife and Alaska photographer Jeff Schultz about his life in Alaska and his adventures with his camera. And that happens to include the Iditarod. So, Jeff, you are working on an Iditarod project right now. You have photographed quite a bit of dog racing, from what I've seen. So, I'm hoping you can tell us a little bit about photographing dogs and Iditarod and what about that speaks to you so very much.
Well, the Iditarod, it speaks to me because I was good friends with Joe Reddington, father of the Iditarod. And I just went, this is when I was doing weddings and portraits, 1980. I didn't even know how to pronounce Iditarod. But I saw Joe at a fundraising event, and my girlfriend at the time, now my wife, leaned over and she said, "Doesn't he have a kind face?" And I thought to myself, this guy started the Iditarod, whatever that is. And I should photograph somebody famous like that as a portrait, really neat light and in his sled building barn or something, and put it up in my studio and hope and pray that people recognize it and want me to photograph them. That was the deal behind it. But I went out to see Joe, and Joe's the kind of guy that wanted to get everybody involved with the Iditarod, no matter what. And so he showed me slides of him homesteading. He showed me pictures of the Iditarod. He showed me 300 sled dogs. And he said, "Jeff, there's 300 sled dogs there. I'll pick out 20 of them and you can drive them to Nome next year." He literally said that. And I went, "There's no way." At that time, I was a chechaco from California, just up for a couple of years. And he said, "Well, then come take pictures for us." And that I could do. And that's what got me started with the Iditarod. What I love about it is back to what I said earlier is the small animal in the big landscape. Yet it's got a huge canvas across the whole state. So that was fabulous. And then the people that are out there, both in the villages and the volunteers that are out there, it's just a great Iditarod family. But anyway, photographing the Iditarod every day is an adventure, and the opportunities are endless. So I was very fortunate, by the grace of God, that they liked my work, and they said, if you come back next year and donate your photos like I did that year, then you could be one of our official photographers, and the rest is history. It's a
Yeah.
handshake.
That was in 1981 that you photographed your first race.
Correct.
You mentioned Iditarod being full of adventure. It's kind of true, good and bad. It's true for the racers, the dogs, organizers, support, everybody, and you. For you, that includes a plane crash, if I understand the situation correctly. And I'm hoping you'll tell us about that.
Well, tell you about the plane crash. That's a long story. It's actually a Reader's Digest type story because there's so much involved with it.
And you have it in a book, right?
It is. Yeah, it's written down in my book, Chasing Dogs. And so, anyway, well, it's a long story, but I'll just do the highlights. And that's this is 1992. Pilot and I are in a Super Cub airplane, which, as you know, is really small, only a two-passenger airplane. And we're flying from Koyuk to White Mountain, which is probably 100 and some miles. And the weather just wasn't the greatest, but we could see fine in front of us, but we couldn't see the mountain peaks. So we had to go really low around the coast area, which was fine. A few bumps in the road here and there. We even saw some seals popping out of the sea ice and stuff. That was fun. And when we're crossing over Golovin, the village of Golovin, White Mountain was just about 12 miles away as the crow flies, and we could see the White Mountain village at the base of the hill there. And then the pilot wanted to be more safe, and he skirted around the bay rather than going straight across it because the bay was just plain white and we had some low clouds. So he skirted around the lake, and we were using bushes and fish shacks to kind of, spot our way along, plan on going around Golovin Bay. And then suddenly we just must have flown into a cloud or something because suddenly it was just white. And if you've been in a small airplane before, there's a thing they call crabbing, which is where the plane flies sideways in order to lose altitude or something like that. In any case, that's what I felt. I felt the plane was crabbing, going sideways, which it shouldn't have if unless you wanted it to. And I knew that wasn't the case. So the last thing I said was, hang on to it, hang on to it. And then the next thing I knew, we were outside of the airplane. And if you look at pictures of this airplane, you wonder how anybody got out, how anybody survived. So neither the pilot nor I remember getting out of the plane. But by the grace of God, we're here today. And it was a life and death thing, but I didn't realize it at the time. When I got out of the airplane, I had no idea what was going on. I just said, Chris, where are we? Where are we? What's going on? And he finally said, he said, well, he kept saying, Jeff, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. And I said, what? What's wrong? What's going on? I had no idea we crashed. And he said, you're Jeff Schultz. I'm Chris. We're on the Iditarod. And here we are. And anyway, finally, I woke up and got an air-to-ground radio out and ended up getting rescued about 4 or 5 hours later by wonderful people out of Golovin that came out in a snowstorm looking for us. And they wouldn't have found us had we not had that air-to-ground radio. And the only reason I had that radio was because my pilot from the previous year loaned it to me. And I like to have that radio when I'm between checkpoints, that I can radio to a pilot and say, hey, are there any teams coming? So back then, you didn't know if a dog team was coming or not. We could be out there for an hour or two waiting for a dog team. So again, just having that, and then having to have a GPS, removable GPS, which weren't commonly available back then. One of the rescuers had that, so that helped get them to us. So it's a long story, but
Did you either of you have serious injuries?
The pilot had two broken ankles and nearly a scalped head, so he couldn't move around much. I always carry an ACE bandage and put on my beaver hat on him to stop the bleeding. He wasn't doing much. He was worse off at the crash site, probably better off in the long run. He ended up having 100 stitches on his head. I ended up breaking my face because I didn't have a shoulder harness in the plane, so my face hit the seat in front of me. So I have a new nose and five metal plates and 24 screws in my head. So when my wife says I have a screw loose, it's possible.
I'm blessed. And you, I imagine you had your camera with you at the time of the crash.
Yes, but I was nowhere in any way going to be taking any pictures. I didn't get anything out of the airplane other than our survival gear.
But they rescued the camera when they rescued you.
Yes, I did actually mention that. Grab my camera and film, I think. So it was in the film. But I
Priorities.
did have the wherewithal once we did get to Golovin, and we were fortunate just to get back to Golovin. They lost the trail again because it's blowing snow and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, we get to Golovin in the clinic there. And I couldn't talk. I was talking like this because my jaw was broken. So, my jaw was broken. And so anyway, I told somebody to please take my picture and send it to me in Anchorage. So that's in the book. A picture of me that, I look like a seal or a pumpkin. My head is all swollen up. And anyway,
Well,
that.
I'm so glad that you were and the pilot were okay in the end. And it clearly did not deter you from continuing your Iditarod experience since if I'm not mistaken, you've been their official photographer since 1982. You're still their official photographer.
I'm one of them now. I
Okay.
retired as the official race photographer a few years ago. I just honestly couldn't get myself to go out again because shooting the same thing, being a creative person. So they have two other photographers that are race photographers. I am, yes, one of their official photographers. I have so much history of the race that they use my pictures all the time for that. Plus, I shoot a few new things for them now and again.
Yeah. So you've got a project going on called Faces of the Iditarod. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that I really wish I would have started that many years earlier. But when I was getting burned out on the race in 2019, I took a couple friends of mine, real creative people, to dinner, Andre Horton and Matt Walczyk. And they said, "Well, you're burnt out. Consider doing something different. Consider portraits." I said, "I've done portraits." Well, by the end of the night, they showed me some different types of portrait lighting from another photographer. And they also said, along with the portraits, they showed me the Humans of New York project, where it's a picture of a person and then a story about them. But so at the end of the day, this project, there's over 1,100 portraits online of mushers, volunteers, villagers, and dogs even. And not only is their portrait on there with some unique lighting in it, the background looks exactly the same with everybody. So you're kind of like looking into the soul of the person, in my opinion. Then there's also four questions I ask them, the same questions. So you can read who the person is, how old they are, where we photograph them, what they do for a living, blah, blah, blah. And then the answer to these four questions, three of them which happen to do with the Iditarod. And the fourth question I ask them is, what in life do you know for sure? So that goes right to the heart of a person. Who are they? And that is pretty cool. But then not only can you read their answers, but you can hear their voice because we record. So to me, that's a kicker. It's a unique portrait. It's they're answering these questions and it's their voice. And honestly, I've had a lot of great feedback from it. Not everybody likes their portrait because the lighting is pretty different, where it shows every jot and tittle. So many women don't care for their portrait, but I try to soften it sometimes. Anyway, so the feedback I've gotten, especially when I photograph somebody and then they pass away, the family is really grateful to not only have a great photo, but that their words on what in life do you know for sure recorded. That's pretty cool.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Amy Bouchatz. I'm talking to Jeff Schultz, who's a photographer. has photographed all over Alaska and is in the midst of an ongoing project called Faces of the Iditarod that documents mushers, volunteers, participants, everybody and dogs. So as a journalist, I have to know how you came up with this final question. What do you know? What do you know for sure? I'm just so curious. What made you come up with that question?
That was from my meeting with Andre and Matt. I believe Andre came up with that. And that hit me like a ton of bricks, because now that makes this thing just a little more, not necessarily important, but unique and different and worth listening to. And, you know, right now I'm currently in a special phase of this Faces project. You know, for the last five years or so, I've been photographing everybody and their brother, but now I'm on a mission to find and photograph the finishers of the Iditarod, all the living finishers. And that's harder than it sounds, because like there's one gentleman I just met this summer. He ran the race in 1975, but I would have never known how to even contact him. I just happened to run into him. So finding out where they live and then getting contact information is huge. But in any case, my wife and I were recently down in Arizona, getting out of this long, dark winter, and ended up photographing four mushers down there, which was wonderful. And then hearing their stories, you know, one of these mushers ran the race in 1973 and a couple others later, 75. So to me, I'm just going to do my best to travel around Alaska and the lower 48 and try to find these finishers.
Yeah, because this could be dozens of people a year.
Well, hundreds.
Yeah. I mean,
well,
yeah,
new
per
people
year.
Year.
Yeah, but yeah,
new
I mean, in total, hundreds. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, more people have summited Everest than have finished the Iditarod, they say. So there's over 800 and some finishers of the Iditarod. And I have a lot to go.
Do you have a number of how many you're missing right
Not
now?
really, because we don't know how many people have passed on in that. So it's
Fair enough.
Difficult. We're finding some of those.
Yeah. Yeah. As you mentioned, your portraits also include dogs. Now, I have a dog. It is not, my dog is the opposite of a dog that is running the Iditarod. Okay. But one thing I know about this dog and that the dogs I have met is they are very difficult to get them to look at the camera, even if you have a treat. It's like he knows I want him to take his picture and he purposefully looks somewhere else. Do you find taking portraits of dogs to be challenging?
Absolutely. Especially the dogs on the start day or restart day are not impossible, but they take a lot of work. But once you're out on the race, it's a lot easier because the dogs are resting and they're not, you know, unless the musher's getting ready to go, they're just relaxed and, you know, much easier. But yes, it's really difficult. Unless, like last year, I found one of the mushers, she practically obedience trains her dogs. So they just sat there and looked at the camera. It was wonderful. I ended up shooting three or four of her dogs because it was so cool.
Well, I've tried to obedience train my dog, and I think he does a pretty good job, but he's not looking at a camera. So treats, snacks, me begging, you know, it's like he has some sort of philosophical challenge with it taking his soul or something. That's how much he avoids looking at the camera.
Yeah, but one thing I really like about the, you know, you, as I mentioned, I ask questions about the subject. The dog's not going to answer me.
Sure.
So I ask the musher. And what I love about these answers, I hope people take the time to look at facesofiditarod.com. And when you read or hear the musher talk about their animal, some of these mushers know more about their animals than friends of mine know about their kids. And then that they know the personality so well, it's just unbelievable. It's an anti-PETA statement, in my opinion, because these dogs are not put through life and death. They are loved and they are cared for tremendously. Anyway, there you
yeah.
go.
Your questions for the dogs are different than for the humans. Yes.
Correct. It's about their personality. What is their personality? And when you listen to some of these mushers, like, I forget the name of the dog, Blondie, I think. But anyway, the musher says, that this girl thinks she's the queen of the whole kennel. She struts around for all the males, you know, just, you know, strutting her stuff, and all the females are jealous of her. And anyway, it's just, he knows this. It's just the coolest thing.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, the dogs, most mushers name their litters after a particular theme, right? So it'd be the Beatles theme, you know, they got Ringo and John and Paul and blah, blah, blah. Or the musical instrument litter, symbols, one of the dogs that I photographed years ago. Anyway, so that's one of the questions I ask, you know, why do they do that? And then what's the bloodline of the dog? And that's another thing. You know, these mushers are so amazing. They can tell you that dog like five or six generations back or even more. You know, it originally came out of a Joe Reddington dog 40 years ago. And the lineage goes on. It's pretty impressive.
Are there any human answers to your questions that have really stuck out to you? Any particular mushers who, I don't know, just you, yeah.
Yeah, there is one. His last name is Wadidi, and I can't think of his first name, but his answer was, "What in life do you know for sure?" And it was particularly about, we all as humans want the same thing, love and security and such like that. And it was really well done. Bruce Wadicki's his name. He's a veterinarian on the trail. It's just really special. I love that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that sticks with you.
Yeah.
You know, can noodle on it as you go. One of the things you now do in Alaska is give photography tours. Yeah.
Correct.
What is that like? What's it like to take folks about on a photography tour?
Well, it's fantastic because it's like shooting ducks in a pond, right? You're in Alaska, for crying out loud. So, you know, my tours get high rankings because I do teach people photography and they love that aspect. But part of it is just where we go. You know, we fly in a helicopter or a float plane out to places not many people get to see. And their jaws just drop. You know, we're flying in a helicopter with the doors off so that they can take pictures. And we're going over these glaciers and things like that. It's interesting. At first, I was very leery of it because I'm not a people person. I don't, you know, I don't just chat it up like some people do. So, you know, we can drive for 100 miles and I'm not saying much at all. Maybe a little bit of, you know, this is such and such a peak. But once we're out there and I get to teach them, and when I see how much they love it, and then when I teach them something that they don't know about, and their light bulb goes off and they go, wow, this is special. You know, it's really great, especially at the end of the day. We come back and we spent the whole day out there from sunrise to sunset photographing different things, wildlife for a few hours and then something else for a few hours. It's a real special feeling to be able to show people this state.
Yeah. You said you were leery of it first. How did you get into it?
I got into it because I had to pivot because stock photography was going down the dumper. Everybody was giving away pictures. And I sold my stock agency and I wanted to do something. So I got into it by a couple of friends had a company. And so I joined that one for a while and did some tours and got my feet wet. And I just went out on my own because I didn't want to do these one day or these 3 hour tours. You know, I wanted to take people places and do, you know, 7 day tours and do all kinds of stuff. So I went out on my own doing that. And, you know, I've been here in Alaska so long, I've got a lot of connections with lodges and, you know, airplanes and people or things like that. So it didn't take long to get a portfolio of places to go.
Yeah. You mentioned at the very beginning of our discussion today how friendly you find people in Alaska as compared to where you and I are both from in California, how welcoming. And then I think about also there's like a tension there where we find, you know, so many of the places that we explore outside here in Alaska are precious to us. That like a little, you know, almost like a secret, right? This is a place that I want to hold close to me. But at the same time, I'm so proud of it and so excited that I get to live here and that this thing exists to be seen, that I do want to show it to somebody else. Is that how you feel when you take people around?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's nothing better. Like I said, people get this big grin on their face when we're flying over a glacier or hovering over a glacier. They've never even done anything like this before. Alaska has adventure in spades, and the wildlife and the landscapes in spades as well. So it really feels good, and people are really thankful that they get to go to these places, the off the beaten path places. Not everybody's at many of these places we go. There's literally nobody else out there, so
Yeah.
pretty special.
Do you, is there, I've talked to some guests here on Outdoor Explorer that there's a feeling like we need to see these places now before they're gone or they're changed in a way that we can't recognize anymore, and or that, they're just not the same. Do you ever feel that? That, like you need to see this now because it's not going to be here in a couple of years or in 2 decades.
No, I don't. I don't at all, because the Earth's been constantly changing, right? Ice age, everything under the sun. So it's just different. Certainly many glaciers are retreating, a couple of them are moving forward. But no, I don't think so. People mention that to me a lot. Some of my clients mention that to me. But it'll be here in a different way. And that different is good for me. I don't want the same thing over and over.
So instead, what I think I hear you saying is instead of a sense of loss, you feel a sense of opportunity.
Yeah, opportunity, and it's going to be different. So that's good. I mean, I don't want to see a glacier go away, but when it does go away, stuff comes up in its place.
It's I think about when we have wildfires, like up on Resurrection Pass, the
Right.
Swan Lake fire, I believe that's what it was, went through there, 2018. And of course, it's very, very different now. But
And the fireweed is killer out there.
that's exactly what I was going to say. When you go
Yeah.
there now, a certain time
Right.
of year, the fireweed is just out of this world, and
Right.
that would not exist had it not been for the fire.
And I love photographing that fireweed juxtaposed with burnt logs. Looks good. Anyway. Yeah.
I am a enthusiast for the Grand Canyon, and so I felt a real sense of loss during the fires this year that destroyed all the infrastructure on the North Rim and this, trail system that I was really important to me personally. But I appreciate what you're saying about this idea that it's also an opportunity to see something different because I've gone there several times, which is why it was important to me. But now that it's gone, I can see something new.
There you go.
All
Yeah,
right.
it'll come back in a different shape.
Because photography equipment is getting more and more affordable, you mentioned this earlier, everyone's kind of doing this now. Cameras on phones are so good. Folks who may have never have considered professional style photos can now take them. What advice do you have for people who want to get more serious about this as a serious hobby or even turn it into employment?
Well, it's pretty tough. Making a living in photography is not easy. So you'd have to, I don't have any good advice or any solid advice that I think is worthwhile. But if I was forced to say it, it would be specialize in something. Start photographing something that you're really passionate about and make the best photos of that. Don't copy somebody else's picture. Go out there and find something unique. Like that igloo picture I was talking about earlier. We had to build that igloo and make it all work. So sit down and figure out if let's say you like glaciers. Well, spend the time to think about a glacier photo that you've never seen, that you want a unique angle of, whether that's from the top down or the bottom up or the sideways. What can you do that's different that you've never seen before? Make that happen and then do your best. Photography, there's so many options, right? You can be a wedding photographer, a catalog photographer, stock photographer, or landscape, and then just try to sell it. But that's the hard part. Do you get a make prints and get a booth at a show. Oh man, that's a killer way to make a living. I've done it, and it's just hard, and it's no fun because you have to spend money on it and then hope somebody buys it. That's the way to make a living.
But if, you know, if I'm taken away from our conversation, I don't know, not the right thing, but a takeaway, what I've heard you talk about over and over again is following your curiosity and looking for things as opportunities and not being just very narrow about how you're tackling the world around you. And that seems to be something that would apply to this as well.
Yeah, it would. But again, but diverging from that just a little bit, and that is focusing on one particular thing. Like what helped my career was the Iditarod. I've been, by the grace of God, I'm a decent photographer, but having specialized in the Iditarod, that made my career, quite frankly. Not that the Iditarod's not is only a small portion of what I do, but that helped me put That helped put me on the map for my other photography. So that was a good thing. So specializing in something weird, like Andy Warhol, his type of stuff, whatever it is.
Well, there's plenty of weird to go around in Alaska. I think we all know that.
There is one tip I'd like to give everybody that I'm really adamant about. As a matter of fact, you can see it on my Facebook posts. And that is, well, first off, smartphones are great. They're absolutely fantastic. The photography you can do with them is wonderful. When I go on vacation, the only thing I use is my smartphone. But please, please stop shooting vertical videos. Vertical videos is just it. Good composition is filling the frame. Vertical videos, there's a top and a bottom that's typically not filled. Turn it sideways, please, by the grace. But anyway. For heaven's
Fair
sake.
enough. Fair
Yeah.
enough. Jeff, thank you so much for joining us on Outdoor Explorer. I sure appreciate you.
Right, thanks.
Thanks for joining me for this episode of Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Amy Bouchotz, and the thanks to my guest, Jeff Schultz, for taking time out of his busy schedule to talk with me. And from all your hosts here at Outdoor Explorer, we'll see you outdoors.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. Tobin Shelby is its producer, and the program is edited by Ammon Swenson and Crystal Hyde. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed on the show are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can listen to Outdoor Explorer anytime at alaskapublic.org and in your favorite podcast app. If you have a question, comment, or a topic suggestion, email outdoorexplorer@alaskapublic.org.